Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
I don't know why hip-hop nerds constantly want to have this argument about what a freestyle is. Like, what does it even matter?
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 188, a talk with Stretch Armstrong and Evan Auerbach. Stretch and Evan are the co-authors of the new book, No Sleep, NYC Nightlife Flyers 1988 to 1999, put out by Powerhouse Books. The book, as its title suggests, is a collection of flyers from the prime years of New York City nightlife, mixed with some recollections from people who were there. But both guests are known for far more than the book. Evan was the driving force behind Evil Empire Mixtapes, and currently runs the popular brand Up North Trips, which has a website and Instagram account devoted to hip-hop memorabilia, anniversaries, and history. Stretch, of course, was the co-host of one of the most popular radio shows of all time, the Stretch Armstrong and Bobbito Show. The show, co-hosted by Bobbito Garcia, ran on WKCR starting in 1990 and basically defined the sound of underground rap. Just a short list of artists who appeared on that show in the early years of their career would include Nas, Common, Jay-Z, Eminem, Busta Rhymes, Big Pun, Big L, The Notorious B.I.G., and the Wu-Tang Clan. Many of those artists, and a ton more, revisited their experiences in the 2015 documentary Stretch and Bobbito, Radio That Changed Lives. We talked to Stretch and Evan at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, here are a couple guys who really, really, really love flyers, Stretch Armstrong and Evan Auerbach. We will get to the book in a minute, but wanted to start out by playing you something that you maybe have never heard, certainly I don't think have heard in a while.
This is not me rapping on Stretch's show, is it?
Team, the master of the Wu-Tang slang and the whole Shaolin gang is in the house. What up? Living large on WKCR with the main man Stretch Armstrong and Bobbito the Baba, the Baba, the Baba.
What is that? I've never heard that ever.
Yo, this is Prince Rakim, the master of the Wu-Tang slang. And when I'm cold chilling on peace, yo.
Where's that from?
Yo, this is Prince
Rakim. Did you break into my apartment?
Wu-Tang slang. And yo, when I'm cold lounging on Shaolin, you know what I'm saying? I'm always checking out Stretch Armstrong and Bobbito the Barber.
Stretch Armstrong.
Come on, baby. Where we at? Peace.
Riz is about to come out of the back room. I think.
Did you have him do that recently?
No, that's from 91.
Where?
Monica Lynch, via Monica Lynch. She had a 90-minute tape of him doing radio drops.
Oh, okay. I need that.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to have it now. I'm going to rip it from the podcast.
With me talking over it.
Have you heard that?
No. They never got that. Really well done, Tommy Boy, on the promo hookup. Yeah, no, I never got that.
Oh, wow.
But probably because by the time that was recorded, which would have, I don't know, what year was that?
91, I think.
91, really?
Yeah.
Did he say 91? He did, right? Yeah.
But why would she have that? I mean, he was on...
He was on Tommy Boy for the first single.
Which single?
Ooh, I Love You, Rakim.
Oh, we love you, Rakim.
And I love you, too.
Oh, we love you, Rakim.
Thank you.
Oh, we love you, Rakim.
You're far too kind, bro.
Oh, Rakim.
Is that Tommy Boy?
Yeah.
What am I thinking that he was on Cold Chillin'?
The GZA?
GZA was on Cold Chillin',
yeah.
The Genius.
Yeah.
All right, anyway, whatever. My memory is failing me. But yeah, I think by 91, I had ceased to play drops anymore. So they probably said he's not going to play it. So why waste the cassette?
What were some of the other drops, just out of curiosity?
I mean,
100 DJs from across
Anchorage,
the country.
Anchorage, Alaska.
Wow.
You know. But yeah, they had Jay Smooth in the very early days of the Underground Railroad, Greg Mack. But yeah, it's him just kind of like trying to find something funny to say about every single person, you know, rhyming the DJ's name or whatever.
Funny.
Trying to like...
The Baba.
Crack jokes.
The Baba.
Yeah.
Stretch Armstrong and the Baba. The Baba, Baba, Baba.
Did you know him back then? RZA?
No, Bob, no. Bobito.
Bobito? No, no, not
Bobito. This guy? Yeah, yeah, yeah. In 91, no, I didn't. I didn't know him, but I know that, you know, once like we got to know Wu, we knew that they had been listening to the show, you know, for, you know, as soon as they knew about it. I mean, leading up to Protect Your Neck. I mean, in the Stretch and Bob documentary, Ray talks about, you know, listening to the show.
When it came to knowing the right sneakers, going to the right spots, the right jams, the latest news, we had to have disciples that really knew hip hop talk about that, and y'all was the face of that.
And and I hope he was telling the truth, because I'm gassed.
Yeah, and obviously you had in the doc, you talk about the first time they came through, all 35 of them.
I remember going downstairs and opening the door, and it was probably about 20 guys, maybe 30.
We here, man. We in the building. All got masks on.
Whoa. Hold on. Wait, who's on the list?
20 of us. We just up in there.
Peace, everybody. Wu-Tang Clan representing, baby. Representing.
Specifically, it was Method Man, who just started breaking, screaming, we on the list. We going upstairs. Move out the way. I was irate.
They violated you and called you the B word. I just told Meth, I was like, yo, B, like, that's our people's. Whole role is to regulate the people that come in. When he got on the air,
that's
when he apologized.
Yo, we want to apologize to this girl that was down at the front door. It was a little misunderstanding. So I'm apologize to her on the air and all that, because she got kind of offended. All right? Enough respect, baby.
I was still pissed off.
Yeah, that was a slight embellishment for dramatic effect.
Nice. But we're, you know, we'll get into the show.
All have masses on. Dirty Deep all had masks on. That's masks for those of you that don't know what I'm talking about.
Right. Obviously here, you know, the thing that brings you guys here, Stretch and Evan Auerbach, is the book No Sleep, New York City Nightlife Flyers, 1988 to 1999.
Bo, 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 bo. That's me bucking shots, by the way.
11 years.
Yeah.
It's actually, the title really should be 1988 to 1995 with an asterisk, and then the
asterisk one or two, three,
a few from 99. Things.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, there's, I mean, this is, I mean, it's 88 to 99 because the earliest, actually, I think there is a flyer in there from 87, actually. So, who's nitpicking,
right?
Other than me,
like it's a DeBarge flyer.
No, I think it's, I don't even remember.
Amazing.
Anyway, yes, the book.
Yeah, the book. Just start why the time period, you know, 88 to 95 asterisk.
I think, on the tail end of that, I think that's when flyers, at least in New York, started to lose their sense of being something that was an effective way of promoting parties, and also something that had any kind of aesthetic value. I mean, by 99, most flyers ended up just in stacks, piled up at record shops and boutiques, and they would end up usually in the trash can or on the floor. And 88, because that's really when the seed for this book was my collection of flyers, and 88 is when I started going out. So I didn't really have any flyers from before 88. So the book starts out sort of when I became of age where I could go out on my own, mm-hmm. and enter a nightclub. I probably was 19 years old.
I was going to say, of age in New York means a different thing than of age most places.
Yeah.
And obviously, like, the visual styles on the flyers are so varied. Where'd they come from? Was it primarily your personal collection? What was sort of the source?
I think there are a number. I think there are about 30 contributors. So when Evan and I talked about doing the book, you know, I was sitting on a nice collection of flyers, but certainly not enough to do a whole book. And then, you know, much of the initial work was identifying people that had flyers, and then just through research we'd find people that had them, and of course, now that the book is out, you know, every other person is talking about all the flyers they have,
right?
Which is funny.
Yeah.
And they're saying, I'm gonna do a book now. I was like, we just did the book,
right? Too little too late. I think the collection really represents a bunch of people. You know, I was not a collector to the extent that Stretch was, but I didn't know the importance of it. And Stretch was one of the first people who I reached out to seek if they had that collection of it. And stretch with explicit terms as I do. And my idea at the point was, let's do a hip hop flyer book, you know, and Stretch was like, son, this is not just about hip hop, you know?
Well, that's kind of one of the themes of the book, right? Is sort of how eclectic nightlife was, that there weren't these hard lines between genres and between scenes that people might think.
Yeah.
And I mean, you obviously remember that from your time being out. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was just, if you were, well, really, if you were considered yourself a DJ back then, you really played a variety of styles. It was and that was also reflected in clubs, where you'd have multiple rooms, different floors, and you'd have not just different music on different floors, but even within one floor you'd have DJs that were playing a lot of different styles. And it was also, keep in mind that back then, like a typical gig, you know, you'd if you were DJing, you'd show up at 10 and you'd play till 4:35 in the morning alone.
Right. So you're going to run out of records of a particular genre if you stick to one.
Right. I mean, but that wasn't even why the reason why you'd play multiple, you know, different genres. It was just more about you have the whole night. It's like this huge blank canvas to do whatever you want, to take people on a journey. And, you know, I certainly there are DJs that could play. I mean, like there's certainly, you know, dance DJs that could play dance music all night long and keep it really captivating. But even a hip hop DJ wouldn't have played 6 hours of hip hop.
Right.
Because a hip hop DJ, I mean, especially if you want to take it back even further, I mean, the original hip hop DJs were basically DJs that played anything.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, that eventually with the explosion of hip hop as an industry and as the crossover of hip hop into the pop realm, then you had DJs playing rap music all night long. But I wouldn't necessarily say that those are hip hop DJs, because a hip hop DJ to me is someone who really is a master of records.
Right.
So that's what it was like back then. You know, I think now you have, just through the internet, it's really easy to absorb a lot of different music from different geographical areas, from different cultures, from whatnot. And I think a lot of people have this very open-minded, eclectic taste, but that's from the convenience of your home. So you're not necessarily, you know, bumping elbows with other types of people. You're just listening to music. Whereas back in the 80s and 90s in New York City, you'd go to a club and you wouldn't just hear different music, you'd also be spending a good amount of time with a lot of different people. And I think that's something that has been lost in New York.
One of the things that comes up in the book is that a sort of related point to that, which is that some of the social hierarchies were a little bit flattened, that the relationship between, you know, the glamorous people and the rich and famous and the rest of us wasn't quite as stark as it is today, or even as it was once you step foot outside of the nightclub. Can you?
Yeah. I mean, listen, clubs were clubs, right? They were like a place where you would go, and once you enter those doors, you're in a different universe. So you could be club famous. You could also be famous and not get into a club.
Right, like the famous story of the book about Cher being turned down.
Cher was famously turned away from the West 14th Street nightclub Nell's on one of their opening nights in the mid-1980s. According to Laura Nell Campbell, who ran the club, the legendary actress and singer was wearing too much fringe.
Yeah, just because you had money, I mean, in fact, money could work against you at certain clubs. They don't want, you know, you'd have to, I think if you were known to be wealthy, then you had to be extra cool to get in because you know, there was a conscious reaction to money and a resistance to this idea that you can buy cool, because you couldn't back then.
Right.
And of course that changed in the 90s with the, you know, with the real estate prices going up and bottle service and the need for clubs to make a lot of money just to stay in business.
Right.
So they cater to, you know, Wall Street guys with black cards.
Yeah. And so I want to get into the economics
in
of
Manhattan,
it for a second.
At least.
Right. But during the height of this era of kind of the early 90s, you know, of the club scene and sort of club kids becoming a thing and all that, you had so many nights. Just one club owner you talk about in the book had 30 parties a week.
Well, he wasn't just one club owner.
Right.
He owned
Peter Gation. Right. Yeah.
He was kind of the
club owner.
The king of clubs.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably the most well-known club owner. Well, I mean, he became notorious because of his legal problems.
Of course.
Peter Gation, dubbed the King of New York City Clubs, owned several of the hottest clubs in the city at his height, including the Limelight, Palladium, and Tunnel. After a series of legal battles involving drugs in his clubs, he pleaded guilty to tax evasion in 1999, for which he was sentenced to a fine of $1.6 million and a 60-day prison sentence, along with 5 years probation. In 2003, he was deported to his native Canada.
But, yeah, I mean, he was like the Darth Vader of clubs. I've actually, I've gotten to know him through his daughter, Jen, and largely through this book. And, like, he's really, we've become friends. And it's so funny because I used to work in his clubs. And literally, if I saw that he was present.
Something was wrong?
No, I was, like, genuinely kind of shook.
Oh.
Like, I don't think, in hindsight, he ever even knew I existed. Although maybe he did, because I think he was someone that really knew what was going on in his clubs. But he was an intimidating guy. You know, he had an eye patch, and he just, you know, had that. I think the fact that he, you know, owned like these four mega clubs and just looked kind of intimidating, even a little bit. Can I say creepy? I hope he doesn't hear this. But a totally lovely guy.
Yeah.
Funny.
But so I guess I'm just wondering, like, how did that many nights, you know, his clubs plus, you know, all the other nights in the city, how did they manage to survive?
Well, I think people were, you know, I don't know that if I were the age I am now back then, if I'd be going out all the time. But I remember going to Nell's and going to Mars, and there were 16-year-old girls, but there were also middle-aged people that were just wanted to be a part of what was, you know, what was like the center of the world in many ways for music, fashion, and clubbing. It was, you could be excited about going out in New York 5 days a week back then.
Right.
And so I think that, that sort of pre-gentrified New York City, was just really fertile after, you know, after dark. It was that's what sustained, you know, so many clubs, and a lot of these clubs were big, you know, I mean, right. Tunnel, Palladium, Club U, these are big clubs that lasted a long time.
Did you try to track down the designers of these flyers? How difficult was that to find?
Some cases extremely difficult. In most cases, people whose collections that we were able to get, they couldn't even cite or source whose designer it was. And in some cases, it was obvious. And we've had conversations with a couple of designers, Gregory Homs, Hayes did so, and they were proud to know that they did those things. But even in those conversations, I don't think that they knew who their competition was.
And a lot of the flyers were designed by people that weren't designers. Mm-hmm. And actually, those are some of my favorite ones.
Right?
They're just, how do you mean?
You know, you're a promoter. Oh, we need a flyer. All right, what should we do? Let's you know, grab some magazines and cut them up and
grab the cover
collage. I made a number of flyers in the book, and I'm certainly not I wasn't a designer then. I'm not one now.
Right.
The perfectly imperfect ones seem to kind of hold a
yeah. They
space,
just have
right?
a sort of idiosyncratic quality. They reflect the technological limits of the time. You know, before computers. Mm-hmm. You know, making the most with what you got.
Yeah,
I like that.
Definitely. And you know, the very first flyer you have in the book is by Keith Haring, who, you know, people know, of course, as a visual artist. But, you know, can you talk about kind of the role he played in the city's nightlife of, you know, the 80s and
I think, 90s? Well, Keith, you know, he just represents, I think, the intersection of the art world and nightlife and music, the overlapping of gay culture and straight culture. You know, that's sort of speaks to an earlier point we were getting at, just how intertwined things were back then. Things had, there were less borders, less, it was in a sense, you know, if you were down, if you were in, you were sort of part of this sort of, you know, fluid world that, you know, that extended to art galleries, to loft parties, to clubs, to music. You know, Keith definitely was on the scene. I mean, his artwork adorned the walls of Palladium. He did tons of flyers for different parties, even his own party. Yeah, because he's, you know, he's the guy that was, you know, he's one of a few artists that most people could name check.
Sure.
To this day.
Right.
he and his friend Basquiat. You're going to stump people to name one more artist.
And Evan, you have a smiley face on your sweatshirt.
Yeah.
So I wanted to kind of bring that.
He used to be really into Acid House.
Well, that's why I wanted to bring it. You have like about a page. Right, you have a page or two of the kind of like rave.
He's on ecstasy.
Right.
He's on E right now. He's rolling.
Of the smiley faces and the psychedelic colors and all that. Can you talk about that?
It adds to the texture of it all. I think that was a time that needed to be represented in the book. The colorful, vibrant, drug filled era of New York City before there was the Giuliani era of quality of life crimes and let's downsize mega clubs. And, the people who were of that era too, some of those names on those flyers are maybe household names is a big kind of title to put on them, but they are more identifiable names and they were just people participating at the time, so... I thought it would be neglectful not to, and much to Stretch's credit, because again, it's important for me to talk about where my place was and understanding the importance of archiving these things. Mm-hmm. But it was really through a hip hop lens because I'm a little bit younger than Stretch. So the mid 90s to late 90s show flyers that are included in the book is what I kind of gravitated to because that was my experience. I'm not a New York City kid, but hip hop shows brought me to the city. Mm-hmm. And those were the things. And even prior to that, like flyers educated me of a New York City life and culture and a music culture that I couldn't Google that. We're talking about a time where there was no reference point to educate yourself on besides getting out and doing it in.
Right. And Stretch, as a DJ during, this period, can you talk a bit about DJs, the role they played, and particularly in terms of like breaking records? Like if you had a new record that you liked, that you said, oh, I want people to hear this, where would it go after you played it at a Nell's or at one of the other clubs you were DJing? What was kind of the circuit of breaking a record in those days?
I mean, there's no single path to a record getting broken. I think it always involves a certain amount of magic. I mean, particularly back then when outlets were more limited, but when you had limited outlets that made the gravity of what club DJs were doing a lot greater, I would say, club play was hugely important and mix show play was, I would say, as important, although many of the DJs that played on the radio were in the clubs, and club DJs that were able to get a buzz ended up on the radio. I mean, Funkmaster Flex got on Hot 97 because he was killing the clubs.
Yeah.
And Emmis identified him as like the guy that knows what's hot, but is also someone who people are following.
By Emmis, Stretch means Emmis Communications, the Indiana-based company that owns Hot 97.
And I guess they imagined that he would be the guy that would translate on a bigger scale through the radio, and they were right. But prior to Hot 97, and prior to, I would say, I don't know what to call it, but like sort of rhythmic club-based music, whether you're talking about house music or hip-hop or anything, I mean, you look at the landscape now, you put on the radio and you hear hip hop, you hear dance music. There are all these genres that at one time really were mostly relegated to underground status, just in terms of style of music. Mm-hmm. So if you turn the radio on, you hear pop music, you hear rock music, you'd hear R&B, but you wouldn't hear hip hop. You wouldn't hear house music. Certainly wouldn't hear any kind of Caribbean or West Indian music. And because of that, it created a dynamic where people would go to clubs, really let the DJ sort of dictate what was going on. It didn't happen overnight, but over time, as radio stations like Hot 97 came into existence and as hip-hop music became pop music, we're talking about 5, 10, 15 year stretch of time, everybody eventually, right now we live in a time where everyone thinks that they know, everyone's an expert. Mm-hmm. And in a sense they are, because they have the world of music at their fingertips on Spotify or whatever, and they've been conditioned to be able to get whatever they want whenever they want it. And that unfortunately extends to nightclubs, where people go and they expect to hear the music they want to hear. Mm-hmm. And sadly, club owners hire DJs that will cater to people in that way. And so, I'm speaking in generalities. Of course, there are DJs that are, you know, have complete integrity and only play music that they want to play, and they stick to that. And that's those type of DJs are more of the DJ as artist, right?
Yeah.
So they're celebrated, and people come out and they exalt them, and you know, oh my God, he played all these. I don't want, like, they, you don't even want a DJ like that to play anything that's familiar, because it wouldn't even matter, because they have that stature. But when you're talking about, you know, the day in, day out average hardworking club DJ, mm-hmm. he's largely going to be just playing to the taste of the common person,
as opposed to trying to find the next thing.
As opposed to, you know, playing, breaking new music and keeping it, being a part of this progressive push forward. Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, the idea of playing test pressings of hip hop records like no one does that now. You're not going to go to a club and some guy's going to be like, oh my God, like, this is a brand new song by a brand new artist no one's ever heard of. It's 1:30 in the morning, I'm going to play it. Like, that's not going to happen. But that would happen back then. I mean, if for no other reason, because the DJ, believing that the song was good enough, because he might have queued it up in his headphones, wanting to see what the reaction would be at peak time.
Can I ask a question to you, Stretch? What was the go-to spot when you had that intuition that this was a banging record that you were excited to go and play at? Was there a place?
No, it could be anywhere.
Right.
Yeah. Hmm.
Cool.
Okay. Yeah. And, you know, we had Salaam Remy on here a couple of weeks ago, and he said that, you know, his father managed DJs. He was in clubs since he was young, and that he, as a producer, would make records that he thought a DJ would want to hear that would have some kind of intro and then a pop in the first 30 seconds or whatever.
I tend to make DJ records because I think that way. Like, what is going to happen in the first 30 seconds that jumps it off? What's going to happen when the beat kicks in and everybody goes, yeah, no, what's the DJ going to think? No, those days it was the manila envelopes that you get in the mail or somebody brings to you and you crack it open. That first 30 seconds when the DJ drops the needle on it, he's looking for something that's like, woo, this is it. He's looking for a way to cut it in. He's looking for his inspiration. And being able to put that into records was a big deal.
As a DJ, what were you looking for in a record?
I mean, I think fundamentally it's about, I mean, I've been wrong. I mean, I've slept on records, and I've also been excited about records that I was less excited about later. But for the most part, you know, you drop a needle in it and you know, within the first, in 5 seconds, you've heard, you know, 8 bars, and you just know, oh, that's funky. Like, that's going to work. I mean, there's no one formula. It's like I said, this is about emotions and magic. There's no, if it was that easy, right?
Everyone would do it. Sure. Yeah.
But I mean, you know, speaking to like what Salaam said, yeah, you could, records back then were made for DJs. Now they're EQ'd, mixed, and arranged for the radio.
Mm-hmm. Back or then, computer speakers.
Right, that's right. Back then, they were made for big speaker stacks. And you just go to, like, I mean, we live in a singles world right now where we just consume a song at a time. But back then, you know, you had a 12-inch with a dub, an instrumental, an acapella, or like a different version for a DJ with an extended intro. The producers got really creative with making records. I mean, Welcome to the Terror Dome, that came out.
So much trouble on my mind, refuse to lose. Here's your ticket. Hear the drummer get wicked. The clue to you to push the back, the black attack.
And of course that was a hit for PE, but then there was on the A side, the second selection was the acapella. I got so much trouble on my mind. I mean, DJs used to destroy that. Here, the drummer get wicked, and the beat would come in.
I got so much trouble on my mind, refuse to lose. Here's your ticket. Hear the drummer get wicked. Yeah.
no one does anything like that anymore. That's just gone. And I really miss those records. I mean, I miss 12-inch records of, I miss record stores.
Yeah, this is not the, they're all closing down so rapidly. One kind of sub-genre that I wanted to get your guys' take on, because my memory of it is so specific, is freestyle. As someone, you know, a little younger, growing up in the suburbs, not going to clubs, the only freestyle I ever heard in the late 80s was the stuff that crossed over into Top 40, you know, the Lisa Lisa and Cult Jam or whatever. Mm-hmm. Can you guys talk about the freestyle scene and how it's, you know, how it's reflected in the book?
I just, I wanted to put that in because the flyers were so good. But, you know, I think I loved some freestyle records. I mean, particularly the early ones. Little Louis talks about freestyle and being a part of that scene, being really active in it. And then I think he was right when he talks about how it became really formulaic and kind of cheesy eventually. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I would never go to freestyle clubs. I was too into to hip hop and house music.
Right.
So I can't really speak on it in that way. I just loved, I mean, the flyers are so good. And because I work so much with a Puerto Rican, I feel like I had to represent.
Makes sense. And, you know, there are one or two kind of famous nights that you touch on in the book that, you know, I was hoping to get a little more information on them. One of them was the Giant Steps night, which was one of the few, if maybe the only one, to actually incorporate live instruments into the club night, into what the DJ was doing. Can you tell me a little bit about Giant Steps?
Yeah, I mean, Giant Step was this kind of progressive scene that was super open-minded, and it putting Giant Step in a genre wouldn't work because it encapsulated funk, soul, jazz, hip hop, and all of the different hybrids and some world music as well. And of course, then Giant Step eventually went on to Morris from Giant Step went on to produce a lot of live shows.
Morris Bernstein started the Giant Step and Groove Academy parties in 1990. Giant Step would eventually expand into a management company, a record label, and a marketing agency. Giant Step also produces concerts in a handful of U.S. cities, including New York, L.A., and Chicago.
And was really instrumental in this sort of soul revival that was tangential to the influence of soul music in hip-hop production, along with Soul Kitchen. But it was a little more alternative Giant Step. I mean, I'll say honestly, back then I was so hardcore hip hop that Giant Step to me seemed a little.
Was it soft?
I don't know, yeah, maybe soft.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought it was interesting in the book that Maurice talks about coming from the
Morris.
UK. Morris.
Yeah.
Morris.
Yeah.
Man, I'm butchering everybody.
No, trust me, he gets that all.
Talks about coming from the UK and seeing that soul funk kind of place to listen to that music was devoid in New York City.
He was really, mm-hmm. he was saying jazz club.
Right, jazz. So
he'd go to jazz clubs and they'd be sit-down jazz clubs where you'd see jazz.
Sure.
Right. Like the UK, what would become the acid jazz scene.
Mm-hmm. People was, actually dancing while listening to
yeah,
jazz.
And I don't know, jazz I think is the wrong word for that whole scene, but mm-hmm. That's what stuck and that's what he was looking to recreate in New York. And he did. I have a much greater appreciation for the ethos behind Giant Step now than I did perhaps I was less open-minded than I would like to have believed that I was back then.
Looking back, was that a gutsy move for him to kind of try to pull something like that off here?
Well, it started small,
right?
And like a family affair, and it just grew, you know?
Right.
Yeah. But you could do that back then. You know, you could, I mean, all the great parties started really with just someone that had a lot of friends that wanted to go out. I mean, Soul Kitchen started like that. Deep started like that. And, you know, a number of clubs started with just identifying, you know, the club directors identifying young people that they thought had a lot of friends or were the type of people that could pull a lot of people together.
Yeah.
I mean, they weren't really professional promoters, right?
Yeah, they became that after throwing successful parties. Yeah. Out of all the flyers in the book, what's one that each of you looks at and says, oh, I really wish I could have been there that night? I guess, Evan, let's start with you.
A tough call. There's so many, man. You know,
yeah, that's for him. That's impossible.
For me,
he's so young.
I'm so young too, and it's important.
He's so young
to talk.
Yo, he is so young.
Gosh, I'm just turned 18 last week. No, it's important to talk about my role in this because I'm not of this era, right? The way that Stretch's, and there's this kind of participant observant dynamic that works really well with Stretch having been behind the wheels at these parties in the clubs and me not being there, but noting the importance of how that era is. You know, I'm not saying that I'm an internet kid, but maybe the listeners don't know what I do with the website Up North Trips and being this archivist of hip hop and understanding that there's, again, a void of the digitization of these important eras. And, you know, Stretch talked a little bit earlier about how clubs are different. Everything was different in this era, right? You know, let's talk about the iPhone for a second, right? We're talking about the need to be taking selfies at clubs and Instagramming and Facebooking and whatever kids do when they go out. This was an era where that was not accepted, right? So these flyers themselves become the only thing that tells the story of what was happening in these rooms. There aren't pictures of them. There aren't, you know, dime a dozen photographers that were, you know, paparazzi or, you know, anything like that. So, you know, I knew that the flyers told the story in a way that wasn't captured in an early kind of trying to research this. There wasn't a place to come to Google, you know, and I sit here. What's awesome for where my role is I got the best seat in the house to listen to these stories about this era, that the only way that information is passed along about this is in firsthand account. And there's very little. This book kind of really speaks to the first, opens the doors to this era that's old enough to be looked at as historic, but also young enough to be overlooked. Right. When it comes to the flyers that attracted me, it changed. That changed through this process. Like, again, I'm a hip hop dude. I have no bounds about saying that I am a bona fide rap nerd. Right. And I was attracted to those in the beginning. You know, the Run DMC shows, the early kind of like, oh, shit, Run DMC was at Studio 54. Like most people think of Studio 4 as this like disco era club. But there was hip hop happening there, you know, but through the process of doing this book, you know, I became more attracted to the ones that where there was like, wow, these were hand drawn. Look at the artistic, you know, integrity of these things. And this was like pre-Photoshop, right? You know, like somebody sat there and Hayes talked a lot about that. Hayes talked about how much time and effort went into putting these things together and the sense of pride in seeing your flyer or getting daps when you walked into the crowd because people knew that you did a dope flyer and that a dope flyer really meant a dope party. You know, there was not What's poppin.net or whatever the websites are that you could see all these club photos and be like, yo, that's a spot I want to be at. The flyers were the things that told that story.
Yeah. Stretch, any particular flyer in the book of a night you didn't go to and you kind of look at it and you're like, oh, I wish I was there.
That Michael Alig party, right? That was like the one you wanted to be
at. I really wanted to wear my fluorescent diapers for that one.
Alig was a prominent club promoter during the time period covered in No Sleep. He was an important member of a crew of NYC nightlife personalities who became known as the Club Kids. In 1996, Alig and his friend Robert Freeze Riggs murdered Andre Angel Melendez, a former employee at the Limelight, who also sometimes sold drugs at the club, after an argument in Alig's apartment. Alig was arrested and convicted, and paroled in 2014. His time on the club scene, including the murder, is portrayed in the 2003 film Party Monster, where Alig is portrayed by Macaulay Culkin.
I can't think of anything. I could name some that I wish
you hadn't
I didn't
been
go
at.
To.
Yeah. One name that shows up on the flyers more than just about anyone else, and you can certainly correct me if I'm wrong, but is to my eye Clark Kent.
Rodolfo DJ Clark Kent Franklin, a.k.a. God's Favorite DJ, is a DJ, producer, and music executive who has been behind countless major events in hip-hop since the mid-1980s. Among many other things, he is the founder of the influential DJ crew The Supermen. You can find out about his work discovering and mentoring artists, including Jay-Z and Biggie, on episode 139 with Torre.
his name shows up again and again.
You see Clark?
Yeah.
See the love?
What was his role in kind of the era of the nightlife when you started DJing circa like 87, 88? Because we've heard from Rob Swift of his role in kind of like the turntable community.
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, I mean, I've got to come clean. Like, Clark is a really good friend of mine. And Clark was, I would say, probably the DJ that I looked up to the most. I don't know if that's Clark was DJing more than other DJs, but I made a greater effort to go to any party that Clark was DJing at. Mm-hmm. I mean, Clark is still an incredible DJ, but I guess just through time and age and whatnot, and just becoming kind of a more blasé middle-aged man, and you know, being a contemporary of Clark, but back then, you know, as a newbie, I mean, Clark was the first DJ I ever met. I mean, I didn't know any DJs when I started DJing.
That's a way to start at the top there.
Well, I mean, he I actually was a professional DJ before I knew any other DJs. I got a job working in clubs at Mars and MK and Big House before I knew. I mean, Jazzy Nice and Clark Kent and then Frankie and Jules. Those are the first DJs I met. But Clark was larger than life as a DJ back then. It's hard to really explain, you know, just the way I just loved watching Clark just literally, and this is going to start to sound a little creepy, but like, seriously, like, just, I'd be like, I can't even go there.
No, say it, come on.
No, it's just hard to describe. It's just this, as a, you know, every time I go to the tennis matches, see professional tennis, you know, I hit the court the next day, you get inspired to play, and I play so much better. And it was like that. Like, watching Clark without even thinking about what he was doing made me a better DJ. Mm-hmm. He was hugely inspirational, ahead of the game. And then, of course, Kid Capri as well. I mean, Clark didn't rely on a microphone at all. He just DJed and was playing interludes and cutting his name into songs. Like, so if Big Daddy, Warm It Up Kane, he's playing it, and when in the chorus, Warm It Up Kane, instead of Warm It Up Kane, it'd be like, Warm It Up Clark, Warm It Up, and he would just do, you know, sort of turntablist things like that before turntablism was a thing. Mm-hmm. But always kept it funky and wasn't like overly self-indulgent with his skills, because it was, you know, always about keeping people dancing. And of course, he was just like the coolest also, right? Like, he was, you know, rocking his baseball hat and gazelles and just always looked fly. And he was just the man and just hugely influential for me. And I can only think that he was for a lot of other people as well.
Yeah. And actually, he serves a nice bridge into something else I wanted to bring up, which is, you know, your long-running radio show and the documentary about it, Stretch and Bobbito Radio That Changed Lives. Because one of the most affecting, or some of the most affecting moments in the documentary for me, come when you play, presumably for the first time, people listening to either their own appearances on your show,
right, yeah,
or in Clark's case, appearances of someone deceased who they knew and loved. You saw, you know, Clark Kent listening to Big. You saw Fat Joe listening to Pun.
Pun was crazy, huh?
Yeah.
Every day they come to me on Twitter talking about, do I have a Pun verse that no one ever heard? By the way, you got one.
No, and I know all Pun verses. Yo, my man, I know all Pun verses. I listened to that shit right there. I was like, what the fuck? I didn't even know I was in the background. I was like, yo, this is some shit. I never even heard this shit. This thing is killing it.
And in both cases, they had never heard what we played them.
Wow.
Ever.
Never. Yeah, that's amazing. I guess, what was it like being in the room for some of those moments? And obviously a bunch of people listening to Big L, a bunch of the Digging the Crates.
Yeah, we did that with every artist interviewee, plus Clark Kent, who wasn't an artist. You know, Bob and I, we we occupy like this kind of rare real estate where we're not, you know, we're not like these big time executives that can just pick up the phone and call anybody, like, oh, call up Jay. But because of our history, our shared history with these artists at a very special time in their lives when they were still doing it for all the right reasons. I don't think it made the film, but Nas in the interview that we did with him was talking about, yeah, this is, you know, when I was going up to your show, you know, this is before I was wearing the rap uniform, before I had to punch in the clock, yeah, where it was like my job. This is something that I chose to do because I was obsessed with it. And in putting the headphones on the interviewees, we kind of took them back to that time. And even the tactile experience of having to hold a cassette and put it into a cassette Walkman, which people haven't done.
I was going to say that was a nice years, touch too, rather than, you know, that digitizing was part of, them, which presumably you had, right?
Right. That but, was part of this desire for us to take people back to a special time. And yeah, and people automatically go back to that time just by being around us, because particularly in Bobbito's case, Bob hasn't seen any of these artists since the radio. I've seen all these people because I go to Big Willie nightclubs and parties to try to get a job. I DJ more mainstream events, so I'll mm-hmm. I'll be in LA for like the Grammys once in a while, and I'll see Nas or I'll see Jay, or in fact when we had to do when we realized we had to get Jay and Nas, I went to Coachella and found them, like had the VIP credentials, and I found them backstage, and that was the first time I talked to them about doing the film. And I've seen Nas in clubs but for Bob, like Bob hasn't seen any of these guys since the 90s. So like for him doing this was that same kind of like, it was like really like a time machine.
Yeah.
And it was really, you know, you hinted at it, but it was really emotional for these guys. Like,
yeah,
because,
well, it looks like a couple of them, particularly, like I said, around the people who are now deceased. It yeah, looks yeah. like they're about, well, Joe, to, about
Joe,
to be in
Joe
tears.
Started tearing up.
Yeah.
You know, we all know this, you know, once we get on a path and a career, you know, it's like you wake up and you get on the hamster wheel, right? And sometimes you even forget like why you're doing this, because you have a list of things that, you know, you have to do, part of your daily responsibility so that you can pay rent and whatnot. But how often do you get to step back and be like, oh, I know why I'm doing this, because I love doing this, which is related to this, but that's how I got here. And I think for a lot of recording artists, and I even experienced this, this sense of, questioning what I was doing, even in the 90s while doing the radio show. I mean, mm-hmm. I was like, I don't know if I even really love this anymore. And I talk about that in the film.
In the film, yeah, of course.
And I've got to think that there are artists that are like, oh my God, I got to do another album. I got to do another tour. I got to, you know, I got to serve my ego up on a plate to get chopped up by radio programmers and whoever might or might not like the music that I've been, you know, putting my heart and soul into. I mean, it's not, that's, you know, artists can be ridiculous in a lot of ways, but I take my hat off to anybody that, you know, that puts themselves out there like that. It's that's not easy.
Right. And also not easy is doing, you know, the hours of radio drops. getting an yeah. interview. Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess, you know, there is so much in, you know, that you've done, but one of the things that comes through in the film is like you have been around and seen up close some of the best sort of off the top of the head rhymers, to draw that distinction. People are actually improvising in the moment, and you see them in the film, you know, Curious and Common and all these people.
When it comes to a battle, the George will never pass up front. I smoke twice, line up the studs on the wall, and then I give it my all. That means I bend the most with the quickness, and then I chop the lyrics with the slickness.
On the microphone, I'm the kid plus the whiz. What? Got the brother Bobbito, I'm yeah. in like Carlito, around the way high, just like Carlito, plus Stretch Armstrong. Woo. I got the comp song.
More verses than a Kramer, go off like a pager, skills uglier than Craig Mack in your ear, I'm the flavor. My old girl say, updated, my old girl say, boy, you got flows. I'm watching the Bulls again because they got D-Rose.
What's maybe your favorite memory of watching someone do that in the context of the radio show?
Yeah, first of all, I'll just say that I don't know why hip-hop nerds constantly want to have this argument about what a freestyle is. Like, what does it even matter? It's like people still got their panties all twisted up over, it's not a freestyle if it's written. It's like, dude, like, come on. But people ask me and Bob because they, I guess they assume that we're sort of authorities on this. But
right, and it's a distinction you draw in the film too.
Yeah, we did that because I think you know, when someone is doing that, it's a particular talent that's great. Although it's completely boring when it's done by someone who's not great at it.
Hey, young nigga from the west side of town, got a young nigga from the west side of town, red hair, gold teeth, but a nigga not a clown. I'm trying to think what to do.
Right.
It's like, no, just write something and kill it.
But of that particular talent, like I said, you've seen some of the best.
Yeah, Curious, Craig G.
That I got the freestyle skills. Yo, show me the rumble up right now. Show me the rumble up. Fornication? Not fornication. Yo, I went on a vacation on tour. Rappers tried to play me like I saw. Yo, I did the set in 15 minutes, and then I met a bitch in the front of the stage, and quickly I got in it. Stepped to the hotel. Yo, well, you know, well, grabbed out the condom, and I bone long, because I bone well. I had to
be... Craig G in, like, 91 or 90, 91, 92 is so funny. He's like, nobody in this earth... He says, "Earth, on this earth, can see me when it comes to off the top of the head. Nobody." He would kill it.
Niggas on my dick, I play you like PE. I can't trust dick. Black bag, they got stacks of tracks. And niggas be on my dick, they get smacked back. Biggie back, wiggy wiggy whack. Niggas on my dick, they try to run my rhymes piggyback. And they got their ass lost it. I played your ass like a fucking Duncan Hines cake with no frosting. Niggas, they be lost and play you like you're Boston. Pick up the mic and rip up the mic without no costing. G is in effect.
Craig G would kill that. Yeah, who else? And Curious kind of, I think that became such a big thing on our show because Curious, who was he was the third of the trio for the first year or maybe even less, but you know, he really wasn't hosting. He would just show up and rhyme with whoever the guests were, and he would go off the top of the head.
That means I'm versatile, because I can lamp cool out from the uptown scene. I'm not mean, but I'm kind of friendly. Not with the trendy ways of actions. I love to max in, and yo, driving, no, I don't play the Saxon. I play with my voice. George is always the MC of top choice. I can keep flowing on and on and on and on for years. I'm never shedding tears. The suckers get smeared. I can keep dropping style with my man Bobby. So the barber.
And that would make other people want to as well, and then I think that confused people because they're like, oh my god, do I have to rhyme off the top of my head? If I come with something written, is that going to be looked down upon? Can I write something and act like it's off the top of the head? I'm sure that happened.
So there was a stigma even then, though, of that separation between off the top and written.
Yeah, I mean, maybe, but I think people now and then give it too much weight. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think, I'd much rather listen to something that was brilliantly written and fantastic than listen to someone attempting to put words together on the spot. Yeah. Eminem was also, was, you know, like, he's like a computer when it comes to that.
Motherfuckers tell me to stop the violence. Start a fire and block the hydrant. I'm just a mean person. You never seen worse than. So when Slim gets the Sim 16 burst and you getting spun backwards like every word of obscene cursing on the B side of my first single with the clean version. Stopping the short life when you're still a teen virgin. Unless you get a kid.
Like, it's not a problem. I mean, brilliant.
One of the things that comes through another in the documentary is like how important the audience of people in prison and in jail was personally and to the success of the show.
That was our original audience, was the incarcerated population of the tri-state area. Mm-hmm. You know, the people that were locked up that had radios would tune in religiously.
In 1991, I was involved in a contract murder. And I got sentenced to 15 years in federal prison. They would sell Walkmans with no cassette, just radio. So, you know, you got the little radio dial on it. During the times that I've tuned into the Stretch and Bobbito show, it provided me an intimate comfort to just venture into myself to explore the ranges of possibility artistically. You know, I would write poetry, and this is one of the poems that I wrote.
The diamonds in her eyes cuts me at the glance. Her feminine stance sets the trance to begin. Her skin shines with the feline type of mesmerizing kind of sublime reflecting within the mind. Flashes of her occur too short to grasp and too clear to blur. The mixture of a stir soothes my jagged edges. Yes, a whisper coming in clearer and crisper in wedges between. Memories of a femininity and lucidity. V edges of a peaks are layered with streaks of mystifying mysteries captivating me. Her affluence is tremendous, balanced by super stupid, stupendous sentiments. The flavor of her taste is the taste of the ultimate experience. This is a rhyme that I wrote listening to this radio program.
Some of them would write letters to us, and then we would read them on the air, which encouraged just a huge influx of letters from prisons. We had, you know, we had lots of mail from people locked up. And like I just said, you know, we'd read them on the air, and that just made, it's like, wow, we're locked up, but we have a voice. And you know, a big part of our radio show was giving the voiceless a voice, whether it was an MC who would likely have no outlet for their art unless we gave it to them. It didn't matter if they were on a major label or even on an indie label or even had a record or even had a record that was professionally mixed.
Right.
We'd play it. Or Bob would play it because, you know, after like the first year or so, I would show up. Often I'd show up a little bit late knowing that Bob, for the first 20 to 30 minutes, would play demos. Mm-hmm. And if I was out of town, he'd play a lot more demos.
I met this earth named Adela, Far Rockaway resident. 2 trains, 10 miles to see her, as if she were the president. You know, I never meant to fall in love so fast. And yes, emotions are increasing and deleting the past. I mean, in the early ages, I'm reminiscing and gripping the hearts of my niggas as they listen to ill visions and times of my trite disposition. Producing a resolution of togetherness and whatever do
now. Coming up, I wish I knew what I know now, cause Lord knows I thought I knew it all then. Of how to listen, but that's a lesson life taught me. I had to live to learn, cause school would tend to be
the crime urging as if they're urging the suicidal, then pursue the title oratory as you pour the gory dosage up the verbal cholera. I make your path and play the shepherd to the anti-follower. That's Ice King grafted from the leper epidermis. Check the sperm, it's all over. Niggas got smurf nuts burning like butter.
So that became, you know, a big part of, I think, the show of the success, because it engaged people in a really important way. And you know, and when I talk about giving voice to the voiceless, also, you know, what we were talking about early, to read letters from people that are locked up, mm-hmm. And broadcast that to thousands and thousands of people, that was incredibly uplifting and empowering for the listeners that were locked up. And of course, that just made them love us that more. And yeah. and I'm sure that if I had gotten locked up for whatever stupid reason in the 90s, I would have been all right inside. That's my fantasy.
Wanted to ask both of you about this. Is these ways of getting music for, you know, the radio show, or Evan in your case, for when you were involved in mixtapes, that bypasses record labels, that kind of bypasses the normal ecosystem where you find, you know, white labels or demos or freestyles or whatever. Can you kind of talk about how you built up that network, that ecosystem of music?
Yeah, probably from two totally different places. Having like my mixtape affiliation relationship coming a lot later than Stretch's show was definitely in the digital era. So seeking and sourcing music came from some elbow grease, you know, you had to mm-hmm. dig. But it also came from kind of ways that really weren't so were really so appreciated, in the sense that you had, you know, these engineers or studio rat type of people who hung around and took advantage of having access to certain music and needed a way to make a living off of that. You know, so there were times in which an engineer got paid to release some music that wasn't supposed to be out. And in the era in which I did mixtapes, the exclusive was the crown jewel of the mixtape. As I think it has been in a customization down to dub plates and, you know, kind of Caribbean music, into having this personalized thing that's unique to your listening experience. So it came from a lot of ways, you know, and we were talking a little bit even before the podcast started about, you know, some of the relationships between people in the mixtape ecosystem that weren't artists or wanted to use their relationship as a distributor or somebody who pressed CDs to kind of barter an appearance on a mixtape for their services. And that happened, you know. We had guys that when we did Evil Empire, who were what I'm using air quotes to call themselves distributors. Basically, they ran around New York City in their minivan with boxes full of CDs and went from, you know, Coliseum on Jamaica Ave up to Harlem to out to, you know, the Bronx, and made their living selling CDs. And one guy in particular saw an opportunity to barter and exchange his services for a spot on a mixtape. And it was genius of him, you know, to say, look, if you put me on this tape, I can guarantee I'll buy 2,000 copies. And it was kind of a safe investment for him because he would make his money back. He would get that spot on his mixtape, and he would also, you know, be able to walk around the five boroughs and say, I'm on the new K-Slay, or look, I'm on this Evil Empire mixtape, you know. And he built a somewhat stable radio rapper, mixtape rapper career off of it. So, labels, I knew very early in that labels weren't your necessary go-to to acquire the type of music. Nowadays, I think it's very different that record labels see that those outlets as a way to feed, you know, an artist's kind of reputation, and they need that, but it wasn't that way when I did it.
Yeah. And Stretch, what about you? How'd you sort of source your music?
Certainly record labels would give me music, and they'd give me music earlier, you know, whether it's tape, DAT, unmixed. You see the Nas unmixed, unmastered.
You see it
cassette.
In the movie, yeah.
And you know, record labels, record promoters, they really respected the show and the purity of our show. So they didn't really try to promote to us. They would just send me the records, and that was that. I wouldn't wait for the UPS man to deliver the records, and you know, I would go to labels as well because that's the fastest way to get records. But yeah, I was determined to make Thursday night show. I was like, look, if people are going to stay up till 5 a.m, then they have to have a unique listening experience. And as long as I could deliver that, the show was exciting to do. And you know, relating it to mixtapes, the whole idea of having exclusives. My show had a lot of exclusive music on a weekly basis before the mix show thing really even popped. I mean, when Clue, before he was really known, Clue used to try to get music from me, and mixtape DJs actually would tape the radio show and put stuff on their tapes because
could you always
we would have
when they
these
were doing
long
that?
Swaths of music without any IDs, yeah. Or like because we just didn't have we didn't have that high production value, so I would just DJ for an hour and then we'd talk or right. Talk whenever we felt like it. And eventually I'd put my name on songs that I didn't want mixtape DJs to grab.
Stretch Armstrong Show. I love talking over demos because then people can't trade them without knowing where they got them from. That's the whole sense behind a station ID.
And of course, I would have gladly shared if they gave me credit, but that's not how it goes, right? You take it and say, new, I got that new hot shit. Right.
Who did the Stretch Armstrong is now in your world drop?
Stretch Armstrong is now in your world.
Yeah. What's up, Liberty City? You're checking out Game Radio. My name is
That's Tragedy.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Fun hip hop fact.
Yeah. I'd get music from anywhere I could, from, you know, buying independent records that didn't have promo budgets, so all they did was sell their records and hope that DJs would go to the store and listen to their record and like it enough to buy. I lived in record stores back in the 90s, getting tapes from producers, DATs from producers, engineers that, you know, heard someone that was dope in the studio, and even tapes just getting sent to the studio. It was it got them from everywhere.
Wow. Okay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
hey,
yeah.
Did I blow your mind with that fact, bro? DJ Treats.
The doc talks obviously about your transition to Hot 97 and how some of your sort of more devoted fans saw it as selling out. And there's a pretty amusing moment in the movie where you bring in someone who wrote you a very angry letter.
Yeah.
And he reads it out loud.
It broke my heart. The first thing I did was I just wrote this long rant. So Stretch and Bob, personally, I don't think that it's fair that all these fucking Guidos and hoodlums who think they are hip-hop heads don't know the first thing regarding the art of DJing, as well as their lack of interest in hip-hop to such an extent that they are too lazy to stay up until 5 a.m. I have nothing against Hot 97, but something against your decision. And shaking my head in discontent of such a corporate whore such as yourself. Wow!
This sort of like laughs at his...
Yo, that was hilarious, right? Because Bob never showed me that letter back then. And that's because... And it's not... we intentionally made it ambiguous in the film so that it looks like it's directed at the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
But it was directed at me, which made no sense because Bob and I were making that move together.
Right.
It was... I think it was... honestly, I think it's because the guy who wrote it, who's a lovely guy, and like we're totally cool now. But on the way to Nasty Vaz's house, which is where we shot that interview, Bob was like, "Yo, this is we're gonna interview this listener who wrote us this letter. I don't know if I ever showed this to you." And he never did. And I read it, and it's really harsh. Mm. I mean, it's like I was called a corporate whore, a prostitute. it goes on and on and on. And it was aimed at me specifically, and which again didn't really make any sense to me. Of course, then I realized the guy was Latino, so I was like, "Yo, come on, he's airing me out because I'm a white guy." but yeah, and of course he wrote that letter before even hearing what the first show would be like. And mm-hmm. we for the time that Bob and I did both shows together, the shows were different. I wanted to make sure that the listeners that stayed up and listened on a Thursday night would get a unique experience. Mm-hmm. And I think we proved everybody, all the naysayers, wrong, because we brought Stretch and Bobbito to a bigger platform, and we didn't change. I mean, we may have evolved and I may have become more this or more that, but that was more about the music changing, not about any kind of direction from Hot 97. There never was.
That makes sense. Looking, I mean,
and in the context of Hot 97, we were the best thing going.
Right.
I mean, artists would come up to the show, and I mean, Nas once was up there, and I remember he was wearing a Louis Vuitton trench coat. And
very different than the shorts he came in when he was a 17-year-old kid the first time, right?
He came into the DJ booth and he's like, "Yo, Stretch, you got the only show on Hot 97. And it was frustrating because it's like, all right, I'm flattered that like one of the best MCs ever appreciates what I'm doing, but you should tell that to Hot 97. Like, why don't you like evangelize for us and be like, "Yo, Stretch and Bob should have a better time slot. They should have another night." And that just, there really wasn't any of that. Which I think was a little frustrating for me because most of the artists that were a part of the ascendance of Hot 97 initially broke because of us.
Sure. As you see in the film, like literally some of the biggest stars on the planet, you know, appear in your documentary and are effusive about the time they were on your show.
Yeah. But, you know, maybe I was hoping for more than is realistic.
Sorry, guys. What movie are we talking about again here?
Wait, what do you mean by what you were hoping? Oh, in terms of your radio career, you're saying?
No, just at Hot 97. I mean, like, when I stopped doing Hot 97.
Mm-hmm. It's like a one, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is not even important to talk about. So let's talk about the Up North Trips documentary.
Zing.
The Up North Trips soap opera.
Zing.
That's not a zing. That's not a zing, Evan. Chinatown Market, the place to be. You can cut all this out. This is not interesting.
Well, I guess, you know, what is going on with Up North Trips? It's a website. You know, you obviously are promoting the book now and you have a big back catalog of stuff, but what's going on with
I think that this is
a site as a brand.
This is the manifestation of the direction that I had always hoped, seeing what started as a Tumblr going. And at some point that there was this realized, whether it was self-realized or was actual realization, that there was this importance in nostalgia, which was something that I had been doing. But I've been holding out particularly for the right opportunity to do something that's more impactful than taking an internet brand and printing shitty streetwear t-shirts on, you know what I'm saying? It had more historical value. I think that this book is the manifestation of everything from the ethos of what I tried to do with that. Where it goes from here, I don't know. You know, the book is really the shoe-in to something that I kind of tripped and fell into, and what started is like hitting up Stretch or our friend Peter Oasis to be like, "I know you dudes were important in that. Let me scan your flyers and put them on my internet website," has turned into so much more about this historical exploration of New York City as told through the nightlife, as told through these flyers, you know. And, you know, you guys were talking really, you know, about stretches Doc, and you know, that experience of showing people or playing people this unearthed music, sometimes in most cases people had never heard before. And I've experienced with this book that same type of phenomenon of cracking open the book, whether it was Mos Def or Ali Shaheed, where these dudes hadn't seen their humble beginnings in so long and spazzed. You know, like we showed Mos in Miami and was just like extremely ecstatic. No pun.
Yeah.
He did have a song called Ecstatic, I think, of these things. And more importantly, like, I remember showing Ali Shaheed, and he began to just kind of like spill from these like personal recollections. And he was like, oh man, I remember we had an apartment above this club and there was no air conditioning. A tip schlepped his air conditioning from Queens just to put, like, a very unique, similar story to these guys. And, yeah. And that's what these flyers have done, you know, for people. They kind of open up a history of their own experience too. And you know, they're minorly editorialized. You know, mm-hmm. there is some kind of like.
Well, supported... say when's the follow up oral history?
I think
New York
like
City
that's
nightlife.
What needs to happen. You know, yeah. is that this book kind of poses us both as authorities on the subject matter, and has also kind of served as a real good dipstick to an interest of telling the story in which it has never been told before. Mm-hmm. And the book just scratches the surface of that. You know, we particularly didn't over editorialize that with commentary and let the flyers kind of tell their own story. So yeah, there will be more to come. So that's maybe the direction, you know, yeah. is doing these more concrete full documentaries, and there will be more to this book.
Nice. And what's your best Sting story?
What's my best Sting story? He remembered my name on two separate occasions.
Sting?
Yeah, yeah, I worked for Sting.
You did?
Yeah, yeah. I worked for his business manager for about 2.5-3 years.
Oh, that's so funny. I'm friends with his daughter.
Oh, yeah.
Mickey. And she just had a baby with another dear friend of mine. And I DJ'd her and Trudy's, Sting's wife's birthday.
Trudy, right.
Like a year and a half ago, and Sting was, yo, my man was wild. Like,
he is a wild dude.
He was the ringleader. This is a submerser. He was like on the floor, taking his shirt off, like grabbing people, making other people take their shirts off. He's like, this is going to be hot. I was like, look at Sting.
Stretch has a better Sting story than I did. No, it was just the fact that here was this kind of A-list musician, and I handled all of his royalties, which was a job that I hated at the time, and in retrospect, wish I appreciated more.
Wow.
About being the bloodline of the music industry, as we all know, publishing and royalties, and here I was, like, fresh out of college working for this A-list. But he remembered my name on two separate occasions. I'm sure he was prompted to know, but I remember feeling like, wow, this guy is on his game, you know?
Yeah.
That's what he's saying to me,
right? How heavy were those checks?
Jeez. Crazy,
God, it's
bro.
Insane.
It was crazy to me. And at the time, I didn't want to be a pencil pusher kid in the music industry, but I wish I would have studied the ins and outs of publishing. I mean, like, one thing that comes, Roxanne for like 30 seconds was like $40,000 to be in a movie. It was like insane amount of bread.
Right.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Yeah, he's got paper.
Yeah, he's doing okay.
Yeah, yeah.
One or two more things, Stretch. You said something once about being white and working in hip hop that I thought was very helpful, sort of very insightful. You look like you don't even remember what it was. You said that you always acted as if your words were a guest in someone else's house.
Right. Yeah.
And is that an attitude you were sort of always conscious of, or was it just sort of something you look back on and you're like, oh, I guess I was acting that way and I felt that way?
No. I that was... That was obvious to me from day one when I started. As a record collector, before I could even go to nightclubs, that wasn't a thing. But once I started actually going to clubs and then being on the radio, particularly being on the radio, because then you're a public figure. Mm-hmm. And I think you know, if especially back then, there was so few non people of color. That's not the way to say it. especially back then, I mean, I was you know, one in New York City, I was one of very few white people that was in the mix like that. I mean, if you're talking about DJs, you know, there were you know, Duke of Denmark.
My name is Duke of Denmark. My name is Duke of Denmark. My name is Duke of Denmark. Well, I knew you liked this crazy hype sound from New York.
It was Duke. He wasn't on the radio, though. I mean, on the radio, I was in New York City. I was the only one.
Yeah.
And I mean, I didn't even want to talk on the radio. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to do the show with Bob, because, you know, I just felt more comfortable letting my my musical taste and my DJing speak for itself. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that was also because I didn't want the color of my skin to detract from what our intention was. Which was to make a great mix show. Mm-hmm. And I think at first I was unsure how I might be perceived or accepted, but pretty quickly I felt like, yes, even though I was a guest in someone else's house, I soon felt like I lived there full time.
I was going to say, is that still a metaphor that's helpful to you, or do you think after kind of a lifetime in
I think it's a I think it's a metaphor applies? that would be helpful for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like it's something that I even have to think about. It's second nature for me, and I think that's largely because wherever I go, people kind of know who I am. Mm-hmm. And so they don't. I think they look at me for who I am, not because I stand out as this like really tall white guy that doesn't look like a lot of the people in the room at the time.
Sure. And one final thing, as a, you know, Upper East Side kid, I would be remiss if I didn't get your thoughts on the Second Avenue subway.
Oh, I think it's great. It's amazing. My dad lives on the Upper East Side, and I can now get to his apartment without having to walk 10 blocks from the subway. I think it's super cool. Right?
All right.
No, that's not cool.
No, it's great.
It's going to be so convenient. I mean, I was
hoping
that...
I live on the Q in Brooklyn, so I'm thrilled about it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's going to take another, like, how many years before it extends further uptown into Harlem?
Zillion. Yeah.
I mean, that's a little, it is what it is. But, I mean, I think it's going to, you know, make life so much easier for a really, you know, underserved part of New York City. You know?
You wish it was around when you were a kid, since it goes almost right to your corner.
Hell yeah, absolutely. I mean, I lived, you know, when I lived on between Madison and Park, I was right by the train, but then I lived on between York and First, and you're like, you're just stuck in the middle of nowhere. You got to take that stupid M18, I think now they call it the M86, which luckily it would cross 86, but then it would go up and it would circle my block. It still does that. So that was good, but like, who wants to take the bus? Although I met my aunt way downtown. She lives on the Upper East Side, and she took some sort of express bus down Second Avenue, and said it took him 15 minutes to get from 78th Street down to the LES. Huh? People, consider buses. I'm all about the bus. Start taking the bus.
Are we going to talk about the Walk Hill Valley Rail Trail that connects New Paltz to Kingston too?
Yeah, that's a
big deal.
That's coming up.
That's an up north trip, big deal.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, so what else do you guys have going on? Obviously, the book is primary, but what, you know, what's kind of next for each of you?
I think looking at follow-up books, I'm developing some documentary ideas for either TV or film, but they're super preliminary. I'm also trying to figure out how I can merge music and, I don't like to use the word veganism because I think it turns people off, but yeah, for lack of a better word, try to be an advocate for health but within music. I think it's needed.
That's great. When that's done, we'd obviously love to, as a vegan,
yeah,
I would love
absolutely.
To have you back.
Sure.
Talk about that. And so what's going on for
I
you
think
for Up North Trips?
Continuing to build the brand of Up North Trips in whatever direction it should choose to go. The book, similar projects related to archiving or unarchiving certain areas of hip hop music culture.
Eating, still DJing. Oh, you're still DJing.
Eating at White Wolf. Boom.
Yeah. Yeah.
DJing tonight with Clark Kent, Tony Touch, Rich Medina, and D Nice. We have for 4 years we've had like a little DJ crew called the Originals, and we play once a month. And we have the best time ever.
Nice. All right,
yeah, well. And if you're listening to this outside of the New York City area, please go to your bookstore, talk about the book, let people know that it exists. We're looking to come to wherever you are to talk about it and bring a discussion around New York City nightlife.
That's right. And we're about to launch a Kickstarter campaign, which is just going to be a cornucopia of various collectible things related to the book, from the low end of pins to the high end of silk bombers with flyers adorned on the outside, not actual flyers stapled to a jacket, but flyers in the actual printing.
Well, that'll be
fabric.
The high end is the jacket with flyers stapled to it.
Yeah, the last thing too is we are on Twitter. We are on Instagram. No Sleep Book is where we're at.
At No Sleep Book.
At No Sleep Book for No Sleep.
Across the board.
Support the Kickstarter. Do all that cool stuff. Yeah.
No Sleep, NYC Nightlife Flyers, 1988 to 1999 by Evan Auerbach and Adrian Bartos, a.k.a. the one and only DJ Stretch Armstrong. Thanks so much for coming through.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having us.
One of the recurring themes on this show has, unsurprisingly, been New York City nightlife of the 1980s and 90s. That scene was so alive and vibrant that echoes of what happened in places like Nell's, the Tunnel, and the Palladium can be felt to this day. That's why No Sleep is such an important book. You can see scene by scene, year by year, and sometimes even night by night what was actually going on during that crucial era, and trace how hip-hop moved from an outsider music to the very center of popular culture. Join us next week when we'll have the return of Eric and Jeff Rosenthal, a.k.a. It's The Real. The hip-hop comedy duo have a new mixtape, Teddy Bear Fresh, and a headlining show at SOB's on February 23rd. We'll talk about all that, as well as everything else that's happened to them since we last spoke back in 2013. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Once you do that, you'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should listen to an episode with another guest who knows more than a little bit about radio, Rakia Mays, on episode 138. If you use iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating and a review. It helps bring more fans and attention to the show. Also consider helping us out by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a show every single week takes a lot of time and effort from me and Josh, and we really need your support to continue to maintain this level of output. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just $1 a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share some bonus material that comes out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. Become a patron by the end of February to get access to the March file. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
He's on E! Right now.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
He was an intimidating guy. You know, he had an eye patch.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
This is about emotions and magic.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Cutting his name into songs.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Quincy Davis.
Oh, that's funky.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Oscar, how are you going to treat your dad like that? You maniac.
He just wants to run around and be friends. Yeah.